Part 5. What to do. Chapter 10. Red shirt the boys. Boys need an extra year in the classroom. My wife and I were torn. Our middle son, Bryce, was about to start elementary school, but he just didn't seem ready, socially or intellectually. His pre-K teachers agreed. So we decided to hold him back a few months, enrolling him in our local school in January rather than September. At the time, I thought we'd gone too far, and that the four-month delay was a mistake. Now, I think we didn't go far enough. We should have waited a full year. Bryce struggled throughout his school years, especially in high school, in no small part because of an undiagnosed sleep apnea. Yes, it turns out kids can have it too. He managed, just barely, to leave high school with a diploma. At his graduation ceremony, as most of the parents around me swapped notes on which college their child was headed to, tears streamed down my face, tears of joy and of such fierce pride that despite everything, my boy had made it through high school. Bryce's educational experience was not that unusual, especially for boys. Among many of the parents we know, a shorthand explanation has developed to explain the struggles of an adolescent child to stay on track, especially academically, but also in terms of life in general. He's a boy. One night, the 15-year-old son of one of our friends climbed up a 10-story crane and posted a picture of himself at the top on Snapchat with the message, "Hi, Mum." The police were waiting for him when he descended. It's that prefrontal cortex and that risk appetite. As Margaret Mead wrote in 1974, true equality between groups that are different in any way can be attained only by providing for the differences. Mead's idea of true equality might now be labelled equity. When there are differences in starting conditions, treating people the same, i.e. equally, is not the same as treating them equitably. A common visual illustration is of three children of different heights who want to look over a fence. To get them to the same level, you need to give taller boxes to the shorter children. The switch from a mindset of equality to one of equity has been powerful in considerations of racial justice, especially in the US. But there are gender implications here too. An equitable education system, for example, will be one that recognizes natural sex differences, especially the fact that boys are at a developmental disadvantage to girls at critical points in their schooling. This chapter sets out proposals for a more male-friendly education system. Specifically, I'll argue for three main reforms: giving boys an extra year of pre-K before starting them in school, a recruitment drive of male teachers into classrooms, and significant investments in vocational education, including more technical high schools. I'm aware that parts of this agenda may seem radical, but if we're serious about gender equality, some radicalism is required. The gift of time. Starting school a year later has been dubbed redshirting. This is a term borrowed from a practice in collegiate athletics, in which a player is held out of regular competition for a season. The idea got a burst of popular attention in 2008 when Malcolm Gladwell presented evidence in his book Outliers that children older than their classmates do better on academic tests and in life generally. He argued that being either old or young within a class cohort leads children into patterns of achievement and underachievement, encouragement and discouragement that stretch on and on for years. It's worth noting that redshirting is reasonably common. In a 2021 survey by Morning Consult and EdChoice, 12% of parents of school-aged children said they had delayed kindergarten entry for at least one of their children, compared to 6% of those whose children are now over 18. The top three reasons given for delay were that the child was too young, not emotionally ready, or not academically ready. Interestingly, among teachers with school-aged children, the share of redshirters was a little higher at 15%. These numbers are higher than the official figures for the 2010-2011 school year, the last for which data are publicly available, when 7% of boys and 5% of girls had a delayed entry into kindergarten. The pandemic could, of course, be a factor here. But some children are much more likely to be redshirted than others. Children with affluent parents are twice as likely to have a delayed school start as those from a low-income home. There is a similar gap between white and black children. Boys are more likely to be redshirted than girls, especially by parents who are teachers. Children who are young for their school year are also more likely to be held back a year. When these factors are combined, the rate gets quite high. Among summer-born boys with BA-educated parents, the kind of folks who read Outliers, the redshirting rate is 20%, according to an analysis of the 2010-2011 data by the Northwestern University economist Diane Whitmore-Schatzenbach and Stephanie Howard-Larson. Anecdotally, it also seems that redshirting is more common at private schools. And far from being those at most educational disadvantage, children who are redshirted have slightly above average literacy and math scores when the decision is made. In other words, the boys who will benefit least are the ones who are most likely to be redshirted. I propose that all boys be redshirted by default. Introducing a one-year chronological age gap would reduce the developmental age gap between boys and girls. In other words, it would be more equitable. I've shown in Chapter 1 that the gender gaps in learning open up early, but that the biggest differences in terms of brain development occur in adolescence. The main reason for starting boys later is not so that they will be a year older in kindergarten. It is so they will be a year older when they get to middle and high school. Will redshirting work? Would a delayed start for boys narrow the gender gap? I don't know for sure. Such a significant change in education policy is hard to evaluate in advance. But the evidence from studies of redshirting makes me hopeful that it could help quite a lot. A raft of studies of redshirted boys have shown dramatic reductions in hyperactivity and inattention through the elementary school years, higher levels of life satisfaction, lower chances of being held back a grade, and higher test scores. Schatzenbach is the scholar who has conducted the most recent high-quality study of redshirting, along with Elizabeth Caschio of Dartmouth College, using data from Tennessee. The children in their sample were disproportionately lower income and racially diverse. Half were getting free or reduced price lunch in kindergarten. A third were black. Overall, Schatzenbach and Caschio find that being a year older had a positive impact on test scores in eighth grade, reduced the risks of repeating a grade before high school, and improved the chances of taking the SAT or ACT at the end of high school. But the benefits for boys were at least twice as big as for girls, on all the outcome measures through eighth grade. And by high school, only boys were seeing any gains. Caschio and Schatzenbach also find the biggest gains for lower-income students, which, as they note, stands in contrast to the observed patterns in which higher-income children are substantially more likely to be redshirted. Lastly, they find no negative effects on the younger classmates of redshirted children. If anything, they say there are modestly positive spillover effects. So, redshirting provides a long-term positive benefit for boys in particular, especially those from poorer backgrounds, with no adverse effects on their classmates. Importantly, these results were driven not by a relative age effect, but an absolute age effect, which is what my redshirting policy is intended to deliver. One of the most encouraging findings from the study was a big reduction in the risk of being held back a grade later on. Grade retention is massively unequal by race, gender, and economic background. 1 in 4 black boys, 26%, have repeated at least one grade before they leave high school. By redshirting boys from the outset, we can reduce their risk of being held back a year later on. Caschio and Schatzenbach's findings are consistent with another study by Philip Cook and Songmen Kang using data from North Carolina. Their analysis shows that redshirted children are doing significantly better in both reading and math by the end of third grade. Looking at gender gaps within racial groups, they find that the 10% redshirting rate among white boys reduced the overall gender gap among white students in third grade reading by 11%. There's some qualitative evidence here too. An in-depth study by Suzanne Stateler-Jones of Collin College found a much higher level of life satisfaction among summer-born adolescent boys who'd been redshirted compared to their peers. Among those who started school at the prescribed age, she said a common refrain was, "I'm always trying to keep up." But she says the overall message from the older boys was, they loved it, liked being older, no problem with it, can't think of any way it hurt, it only helped. Jones also interviewed parents and asked them what they would do if they had another summer-born son. Automatically, they said, we would redshirt. It is worth noting, however, that this small group was largely white and affluent, simply because this is the group currently most likely to redshirt their children. Taken together, these results point to potentially big benefits from starting all boys a year later. The largest gains would be for those who are least likely to be redshirted right now, especially boys from lower-income families and black boys. I also expect the gains would be even bigger on other outcome measures, such as GPA, which existing studies have been unable to assess. High school grades, for example, are related to executive functioning skills, one likely reason why girls have higher grades. An extra year of development is unlikely to completely close the gap on these skills, but it would surely help. Objections to redshirting. There are, of course, some good arguments against my proposal. I'll address five here. First, delaying school entry could put pressure on parents to provide childcare for another year. This is likely to be one reason why lower-income parents are already much less likely to redshirt their children. This is a real concern. My proposal is to enroll boys in a universal pre-K program at the same age as girls, but give them an extra year before they move on. In other words, boys would get a double dose of pre-K. So as far as parents are concerned, the policy should be neutral with regard to childcare costs. Second, there is a concern that boys who start school later will be more likely to drop out of high school because they will legally be able to leave formal education sometime before their high school education is complete. It's hard to know how big a problem this would be. Data analysed by the education economists David Deming and Susan Donarski do not show much impact on high school graduation rates among those who start school a year later, though they do show a delay. But as we've seen, this group is hardly representative. Today's redshirted children are from more advantaged backgrounds, and so much less likely to drop out of high school in any case. One thing that would help here is to raise the legal age for leaving school to 18, which about half of US states have already done. Third, a related objection is that boys will lose a year in the labor market once they become men, potentially reducing their lifetime earnings. This is one of the main concerns of Deming and Donarski. As they point out, holding constant retirement age, a person who starts school a year later spends one less year in the labor force. The financial losses from starting one year later consist of one year of labor market earnings, as well as the lifetime return to that lost year of labor market experience. Again, this is a reasonable fear, but it is one that applies to any policy that increases the number of years spent in school at whatever age. You might spend 2 years in community college, for example, and leave without any kind of credential. The truth is that right now, few young men are hitting the labor market at full stride out of secondary education. Almost one in five don't finish high school on time. Of those who start community college, fewer than one in three have gained a qualification 3 years later. More than 1 in 10 young men aged between 16 and 24 are disconnected, i.e. neither in paid work nor in education. My point is simply that we should not assume that the extra year of learning will mean a lost year of earnings. If it helps to improve outcomes for boys, as I believe it will, it should improve labour market prospects. Fourth, there is a question of how to phase in the reform. If we were to suddenly hold a whole cohort of boys back for a year, there would be a single female-only cohort going through the education system, which would be distinctly odd, especially for them. My suggestion is to phase the policy in over a few years, starting with the youngest boys and gradually expanding the age range each year until all boys are covered by the policy. Perhaps a third of the boys could be redshirted in the first year, 2/3 in the second year, and all of them only in year 3, for example. This would also create a natural experiment for social scientists to evaluate the benefits of redshirting for boys of different ages. Last but not least, would it be legal? Let's imagine that a school district or state adopts my plan. Some legal challenge would likely be mounted, perhaps by the ACLU. They would cite Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which prohibits discrimination on the basis of sex, and possibly the Equal Protection Clause in the 14th Amendment. The defense would be that girls and boys are different in terms of their development, and that such differences can be taken into account in education policy without breaching Title VII. A famous case of the Virginia Military Institute, an all-boys school, would surely be cited. In 1996, the Supreme Court forced the institute to open its doors fully to women. Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg penned the majority opinion. Importantly, the court did not dispute the claim that there are differences, on average, in the way boys and girls learn. As Ginsburg wrote, this, however, did not provide a justification for excluding girls, whose talent and capacity place them outside the average description, i.e., who learn more like a typical boy. Today, around 12% of students at the institute are women. The court ruled that in order to exclude one sex entirely from a public educational institution, the state must provide an exceedingly persuasive justification. But my proposal is not to exclude either sex from any institution, merely to slightly stagger the default age at which boys and girls move on from preschool to kindergarten on the grounds of their different developmental trajectories. Parents would be at liberty to override the default, to either hold back their daughter or accelerate their son, just as they mostly are in the current system. All this said, there are clear legal challenges to explicitly basing a policy on sex differences, which need to be considered in design and implementation. So I think there are reasonable answers to these reasonable concerns with my Red Shirt the Boys plan. The only way to find out for sure is to do it. Initially in the form of some pilot programs, perhaps in a selection of school districts in a range of settings. I expect these would show good results in terms of reducing the gender gap in education and a good return on investment. But of course, I could be wrong. That is why evaluation studies are so important. Let's find out. More men teaching boys. Right now, boys and school don't mix too well. Around the world, boys are twice as likely as girls to say that school is a waste of time, according to a survey commissioned by the OECD in 2015. In the US, boys are three times as likely as girls to be expelled from school and twice as likely to be suspended. There are a number of reforms that might improve the school environment for boys, including more physical education, a later school start time, and better food. Exercise, food, sleep. All in all, the education system needs to do a much better job of recognizing that students are flesh and blood and not just brains on a stick. Of course, these reforms would benefit girls too. But one school reform would dwarf all of these. More men at the front of our classrooms. In the US, the proportion of male teachers is low and falling. The male share of K-12 teachers is now 24%, down from 33% at the beginning of the 1980s. Male teachers are especially scarce in elementary and middle schools. Similar trends can be observed in other nations, including the UK and South Korea. If the trend continues, we may see a day when 8 out of 10 teachers will be female, write Richard Ingersoll and his colleagues in a 2018 report from the University of Pennsylvania. They add that an increasing percentage of elementary schools will have no male teachers. Given the importance of teachers as role models and even as surrogate parents for some students, certainly some will see this trend as a problem and a policy concern. Honestly, I don't know how anyone could not see this trend as a problem, but it is important to spell out why. For one thing, if children grow up seeing care or education as women's work, this reinforces gender stereotypes across generations. As Gloria Steinem said in 1995, The way we get divided into our false notions of masculine and feminine is what we see as children. There is also solid evidence that male teachers boost academic outcomes for boys, especially in certain subject areas like English. The potential upsides here are quite large. Education researcher Thomas Dee estimates that if half the English teachers from 6th to 8th grade were male, the achievement gap in reading between girls and boys would fall by approximately a third by the end of middle school. Notably, the performance of girls in English seemed not to be affected by teacher gender. A separate study in Chicago found that in classes with a male teacher, the gender gap in 9th grade GPA was almost halved. When the share of men teaching in Finnish primary schools was boosted by a 40% quota for training courses, both boys and girls did better in school. The quota was scrapped in 1989, and the share of men entering primary teaching halved. The policy ended because of a sex discrimination law passed in 1987. But in 2005, the Finnish government instituted a legal requirement on every state-owned company to have at least 40% women on their board. I'll admit to a lack of expertise on the intricacies of the Finnish legal system, but surely something is awry here. But I digress. While the evidence that male teachers matter is strong, the precise mechanisms are not well understood. Attitudes may be one factor. Female teachers are more likely than male teachers to see the boys in their class as disruptive, while male teachers tend to have a more positive view of boys and their capabilities. There may also be a role model effect. It's worth mentioning here that the race of teachers is important too, and that teaching skews even more white than it does female. But it seems that black boys benefit most from having a black teacher. As Lizette Partelow, an education scholar at the Progressive Center for American Progress, writes, having both male and female teachers is likely good for students for many of the same reasons that they benefit from a racially and ethnically diverse teacher workforce. What is required here is a massive, urgent recruitment effort. In an ideal world, we would have similar numbers of male and female teachers all the way from pre-K classrooms to PhD seminars. Huge progress has been made on college campuses, where women now make up almost half of full-time faculty, 47%. Women also account for over half the heads of university and college departments, 40% of deans, and 30% of college presidents. The American Council on Education has set the goal of reaching complete gender parity in college leadership by 2030. Given the recent upward trend and the fact that half of current college presidents say they plan to leave their position in the next 5 years, this ambitious goal looks achievable. The council calls it the Moving the Needle Initiative. In higher education, then, we've seen real progress towards gender balance at all levels and the setting of clear goals for the future. Meanwhile, in K-12, we are moving further away from gender parity with every passing year, and no goals have been set. Surely, moving the needle here is at least as important. As an initial step, we should set the target of reaching 30% male representation in K-12 teaching. School districts could be asked to pledge to reach the goal. Specific efforts are also needed to recruit more men into early years education, more black men, and more male English teachers. Early years education is close to being an all-female environment. It ought to be a source of national shame that only 3% of pre-K and kindergarten teachers are men. There are now twice as many women flying US military planes as there are men teaching kindergarten as a share of the professions. The barriers to male recruitment in this field are high, according to an in-depth study of 46 male educators working in pre-K and kindergarten classrooms in New York by Kirsten Cole of Manhattan Community College and her colleagues. Stigma is one major challenge. Many of the men had been advised to make sure they were never alone with a child and to be wary of any physical contact. Just as I was writing this chapter, my son called to say that he'd been turned down for a childcare job because the parents were uncomfortable about leaving their children with a man. At least they were honest about it, he said. On the upside, many of these educators said they felt proud that they were providing positive male role models for young children, and reported many parents being delighted that their children would have a male teacher. Cole and her co-authors urge concerted policy efforts to attract and retain more men in early education. As they write, because of their current scarcity in the field, male educators may also require intentional supports that address the particular circumstances they face related to bias and isolation. They propose targeted recruitment of men into the field, modeled on programs like NYC Teaching Fellows, which supports professionals making career transitions into teaching in high-need subject areas such as math, science, and special needs in underserved New York schools. Philanthropic foundations serious about gender equity should be flooding the education market with generous college scholarships for men who want to pursue a career in early years education, just as they have supported girls interested in STEM careers. The second priority is to recruit more black men into teaching. As a black male teacher, sometimes I feel like a unicorn, says Charles Jean-Pierre, a DC public schools art and French teacher. This is not surprising. Black men account for just 2% of teachers in the US. As I've already mentioned, black boys in particular seem to benefit from having a black teacher. There are now a range of initiatives, mostly at the city level, to boost the number of black male teachers, including NYC Men Teach, the National Association of Black Male Educators, the Male Teacher of Color Initiative, the Black Male Educators Convening, and so on. But many of these are operating on shoestring budgets and in urgent need of support. In Columbia, South Carolina, School Superintendent Baron Davis has set the explicit goal of hiring an extra 100 male teachers of color, with a particular focus on black men, which would bring their representation up to 10% in his district. This is the kind of intentionality and specificity we need for a nationwide affirmative action program for male teachers. You can't keep saying there's not enough black men in education, says Davis. The question is, he says, what are you going to do about it? I think the same can now be said of men in education generally. The third recruitment priority is to get more men teaching English. Literacy and verbal skills are where boys lag furthest behind girls, and these skills matter a lot to later educational prospects. One study finds that moving US students up by a single letter grade in ninth grade English increases the probability of college enrollment by 10 percentage points. The extra year that boys would gain from redshirting would certainly help here, but so would more male teachers in the appropriate subjects, especially English. Remember that having a male English teacher improved results for boys with no negative impact for girls. So the more men teaching English, the better. Currently, men account for 12% of the English teachers in middle school and 23% of those in high school. Most policy efforts in terms of teacher recruitment are currently focused on attracting more teachers, male or female, into STEM subjects. This is important, of course. But I would say that there is now an equally urgent need to get more men teaching English. One option is to borrow an idea from the STEM field and provide college students majoring in English the opportunity to gain their teacher accreditation at the same time, reducing the years of study. Obviously, this might be attractive to both men and women. Less talk, more shop. The third major policy reform I propose is a massive investment in male-friendly vocational education and training. Our educational system is tilted towards the standard academic track, up to and including a four-year college degree. I've talked a fair amount about college in earlier chapters, but many people do just fine without a four-year college degree. In fact, 16% of people with a high school diploma and 28% of those with an associate's degree make more money across their working life than the median person with a bachelor's degree, according to a study by Georgetown's Anthony Carnevale and his co-authors. As they observe, the simple advice to high school students to go to college no longer suffices. Carnevale says we need more career counselors in high schools with the skills and information to help students see a range of options. Sometimes the job title is college and career counsellor, but it is usually the former that gets the most attention. We should strive for more gender balance here too. Right now, only one in four guidance counsellors is a man. The singular focus on the traditional college route sends a strong signal that some skills are more valuable than others, specifically the ones that make you college ready. There is a lot I could say here about the classism and the cult of smart that underpins a lot of thinking and policy in this area, but one upshot has been a persistent undervaluing of vocational learning. This has been harmful in general, but especially for boys and men. On average, male students seem to do better with a more hands-on and practical approach to learning, and so benefit most from a more vocational approach. But there has been a precipitous decline in career and technical education, CTE, in American schools, a result of the go-to-college obsession, and a residual fear of tracking some students away from more academic classes. Between 1992 and 2013, the last year for which data are available, the number of CTE credits earned by US high school students dropped by 17%. Federal spending has declined in the last few decades. High school curricula need more hands-on elements. This doesn't mean sending all the boys into shop class to learn a trade while the girls polish their college application essays. But it does mean incorporating more practical and more vocational elements, i.e. CTE, into the general curriculum, and especially creating more standalone technical high schools. The broader goal here is more of what philosopher Joseph Fishkin calls opportunity pluralism. Rather than a single narrow path in what he calls a unitary opportunity structure, there should be many different routes to success. How much can CTE help boys in particular? The evidence base here is not very broad, but what there is looks encouraging. A few high-quality studies stand out. The first examined the impact of career academies, which are small, vocationally-oriented high schools. There are an estimated 7,000 of these academies across the nation, although they vary greatly in their approach. The evaluation study by MDRC looked at 9 academies in New York. On traditional education metrics such as grades, test scores, and college entry, they were a failure. But male students from these schools, mostly Hispanic and Black, saw a 17% earnings boost, equivalent to an extra $30,000 over the 8 years of the follow-up study. This wage bump is similar to the one for students completing 2 years of community college. Strikingly, for young women graduating from the academies, there was no apparent benefit on any measured outcome, an exception to the rule of educational interventions overall that I described in Chapter 6, and further evidence that CTE is a particularly male-friendly educational approach. A second study examined the impact of a statewide system of 16 CTE schools in Connecticut, which collectively educate about 11,000 students, 7% of those in the school system. Male students at these schools had a graduation rate 10 percentage points higher than in traditional schools, and their wages were 33 to 35% higher by the age of 23. Again, there were no apparent gains for female students. These US studies echo similar findings from a study in Norway, where a new vocational track in high school boosted earnings for male participants. As the authors Marianne Bertrand, Manya Mogstad, and Jack Mountjoy write, considerations related to differential benefits by gender should be an integral part of the policy conversation surrounding vocational education. In recent years, there have in fact been some welcome signs that policymakers are warming to investments in CTE. A number of states have boosted funding. Nevada, for example, tripled CTE investment. In 2018, the Carl D. Perkins Career and Technical Education Act was reauthorized, providing an annual $1.3 billion to states to support funding for CTE. This is good as far as it goes, but compared to the $150 billion supporting college education, it does not go very far. Another problem is that almost all of the investment in CTE goes to within-school courses, even though the best evidence on the benefits of CTE is from whole school approaches. We need more CTE in every school, for sure. But more importantly, we need more CTE schools. By my estimates, there are currently around 1,600 technical high schools in the country, accounting for about 7% of all public high schools. These are clustered in large urban or suburban school districts in the Northeast. Overall, only 12% of school districts have a CTE school. We should aim to add at least 1,000 new technical high schools across the nation by 2030. If the federal government offered states a subsidy of $5,000 per student for these schools, this goal could be achieved for around $4 billion a year. These new schools would, of course, be open to boys and girls. But given the results of the evaluation studies, it would make sense to market them to male students. Beyond high school, there is a strong case for expanding apprenticeships. The National Apprenticeship Act, which passed in the House of Representatives in 2021, would invest $3.5 billion over 5 years to create nearly 1 million new apprenticeships. This kind of investment is urgently needed. Let's hope the Senate thinks so too. Despite some recent growth, the US remains stuck right at the bottom of the international table for the number of adults taking apprenticeships, at around 636,000. Community colleges also offer vocational courses, leading to higher employment and earnings, especially those in health, business, and STEM. These colleges are also the most common post-secondary destination for young adults in the US. By comparison, an associate's degree in a liberal arts subject is not a great investment in terms of labor market outcomes. At least $20 billion a year should be diverted towards community colleges through a new federal grant program, along with more incentives to ensure that the students complete their studies, especially in subjects leading to the best job prospects. All of these reforms will take time. As Oren Kass, head of the center-right think tank American Compass, writes, refocusing education reform from an obsession with college to a respect for the other pathways that young people can follow into the labor market will be a long, slow process. So we'd better get started. I've focused here on vocational routes, but I'll make just one plea on colleges. I would like to see more countries or US states following the lead of Scotland, which as part of its gender action plan has set the goal of reducing the gender gap in undergraduate enrollment to 5 percentage points. This will be a challenge, given that the difference is currently 17 percentage points. But the Scottish government stands out for clearly stating that gender inequalities in both directions matter, and for setting specific targets to address them. Finally, I should probably mention one policy proposal that I do not endorse: more single-sex schooling. This solution comes up quite a lot in discussions of how to help boys. There are a few studies showing impressive effects, including one from 20 schools in Trinidad and Tobago. But overall, the research does not suggest much benefit to either boys or girls from separate schooling. It may be that single-sex education provides particular benefits for certain groups, including black boys. There just isn't strong evidence either way on this specific question. It is certainly true that, as Michael Gurian puts it in the title of his book, Boys and Girls Learn Differently. But this difference is better addressed by revising teacher education courses to include some of the scientific evidence on sex differences, as Gurian urges. Currently, they do not. Many of the differences between boys and girls in today's classrooms are because the girls are just much older, developmentally speaking. We can send boys to the same schools as girls just a year later.